Welcome, and thanks for listening to a USGS Corecast. I'm Scott Horvath. Today we're going to talk about bats and white nose syndrome. So without further ado, I wanted to go ahead and welcome Paul Cryon. He's a research biologist with the USGS out in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And also on the phone from Madison, Wisconsin is Kimberly Miller. Do you want me to call you Kim or Kimberly?
Sure, yes, Kim's fine.
She's a wildlife disease specialist with the USGS National Wildlife Health Center. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
In the winter of 2007, I believe, this is when this whole white nose syndrome started, popping up. And it's affecting tens of thousands of bats in the northeastern United States. So the thought was that this was going to probably sort of subside and go away as springtime approached. But then it started coming up again. What I want to know from the two of you is, can you tell us just a little bit about what white nose syndrome actually is and sort of, you know, why is this resurfacing all of a sudden again?
Sure. It first was noted, as she said, in February of 2007 by one of the wildlife biologists in New York. And what he was saying was bats flying outside of the hibernaculum in the wintertime. And also bats with this white substance around their nose. Now, that's how it got its name, white nose syndrome.
Right.
That white substance, though, is not on every affected bat, and it can be seen on other places on the bat other than their nose. Then this year, the biologists in New York, but also some other states as well, started seeing affected bats. So we had bats in multiple locations in New York, Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, later on in the season. And we were then seeing bats displaying these unusual behaviors of being outside of the hibernaculum in the winter, flying in the daytime, and massing near the entrance of the hibernaculum. And these are all things that they really shouldn't be doing. And they were also seeing bats with the white nose on their face. So that's kind of how it got its name and a little bit of the background. So the disease was seen in many more areas this year as compared to last year. And why that is, we don't know. We're not sure whether it's an infectious disease. The white substance on their faces and bodies appears to be a fungus, but we haven't been able to consistently culture, you know, one particular fungus from these bats. So it could just be that that is just sort of something that's not the primary problem. It may be that there's some other thing, and these bats are more susceptible, and so they're more susceptible to other disease problems, and this white fungus that we're seeing on them may not be, you know, the primary cause of why these bats are affected.
Right. And you said that there's other parts of the body it does, or other parts of the bat that it can't appear on other than the nose?
Yeah, it's been noted on the wings, on the body, on the legs. So it has been seen other places other than the nose. The
right.
ear tips, for example, they've seen white material on the ear tips.
Okay.
But again, it's not every bat that appears to be sick has white nose.
Only certain bats for whatever
right,
reason, yeah.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and of course, you know, obviously, you know, this whole topic is about bats, and people always, you know, we'll say always, but they sometimes think of when you mention the word bats or you mention something about a bat, you know, it's this idea of like Count Dracula or, you know, vampire bats or, you know, something like this, something you see in the movies or TV. So they obviously have this fearful reputation, but they're pretty vital to the biological environment. So can you sort of explain what,
can you explain
what that's about?
Yeah, most of those popular, what we call misconceptions about bats are just dead wrong. Globally, bats play very, very important roles in most of Earth's ecosystems. There's about 1,100 species of bats on Earth. And in tropical areas, they play very important roles as seed dispersers, pollinators of plants. They eat a lot of insects. And here in the U.S., we have about 45 species of bats. The majority of them, about 42, are primarily insect-eating. We also have a few that occur in the desert southwest that play important roles in the pollination of large columnar cacti and agave century plants. But here in our neck of the woods, most of the bats are feeding on insects, and they consume tremendous amounts. We're just now starting to get a feel for how much they play a role as insectivores in our environment. But the best example we have is from an area of Texas where there's a large concentration of a species that we call the Brazilian free-tailed bat.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a study done in an 8-county region of Texas, and they found that those bats just in that 8-county region were probably consuming somewhere around 2 million pounds of insects each night during summer when they're in the area.
Wow.
Leading to about 400 metric tons of insects a year. And they extended those results to an economic analysis. Mm-hmm. And in that area, the pest control services those bats played probably equated to about $1 or $2 million in the prevention of crop damage and application of pesticides by farmers in that area. So that's just one species of the 44 that we have, and you can imagine that these other bats are having a tremendous impact, too. We just don't really know how our ecosystems would function if some of these bats were taken out of the picture, and that's one of the big concerns with white-nose syndrome. Is we've never seen consistent and widespread die-offs in bats like this. In general, they're not susceptible to epizootic diseases, that you don't see mm-hmm. these diseases raging through their populations and killing large numbers. And their populations, they're very slow to reproduce. They have one young per year here in this part of the world. They grow slowly. They take a long time to get those young up and running. So they don't bounce back from these kind of catastrophic population impacts. And
they're severely affected by this. I mean, it's obviously it affects their growth and the expansion of their own species, I guess.
Yeah, and some estimates are putting it at hundreds of thousands of bats in the affected area dying of white nose.
Well, is it only certain species, or is there like a certain number of species that so far that are affected, or?
It's been primarily the little brown bats, but also the large brown bats, eastern pipistrel, and then the Indiana bat, which is an endangered species.
Yeah, these are mostly hibernating species. There are other species of bats that occur in that region that roost in trees primarily, mm-hmm. or other types of roosts during winter, but we're mainly seeing this in the hibernating species that aggregate in caves and mines.
Okay.
And also, I should say, the northern long-eared bat as well has been involved. One thing I wanted to second that Paul had said was that we really don't get reports of large-scale bat mortality. In one of the locations in Vermont, one of the caves, they had been going in and surveying those populations and finding, you know, a few thousand bats. Well, some cavers had gone into the cave and moved some of the rocks and found that there was a whole other chamber way, you know, further back, hadn't ever been accessed by people. And so when they went back in there and did population counts, they found like another 20,000 bats. My point being is that we don't typically get these large die-offs of bats, but in the caves and hibernaculum and mines that people do visit or do surveys of, we haven't historically gotten reports of mortality in those areas. So it is kind of a new finding to have.
Yeah, the bat researchers have been visiting a lot of these sites for the past 80 to 100 years, and the situation with white-nose syndrome was so alarming that there's really been a response by the bat research community, and I think the feeling among a lot of us that work with bats is that this is something very unusual and very serious. So.
Well, and along those lines, what is the USGS and other federal wildlife agencies doing to sort of learn more about this disease and what's happening in that area?
Well, here at the center, we are a diagnostic and research center, and our whole focus is on disease prevention, detection, and control in free-ranging wildlife.
Okay.
So really kind of unique in that aspect. We receive phone calls and things from biologists, both at the state and federal level, regarding wildlife health issues or problems or mm-hmm. concerns, and oftentimes they're calling about something that's died. And that's what happened in this case. Biologists called in, talked to our field folks, the other wildlife disease specialists here, about what they were seeing, bats acting unusual, and submitted carcasses to us. They come into our diagnostic lab where they're worked up by our veterinary pathologist. And what they're doing is it's called a necropsy, and that's really like a human autopsy. They're examining these bats inside and out, looking for things that both look normal and look abnormal. And they collect samples of the skin and the fungus from around the nose or off the body to send to our various labs to look for bacteria and viruses, parasites. And they also collect a number of tissues to look at microscopically. And the point of all of this is really to try and, it's like putting together a puzzle. And we're really trying to put all of those things together into a coherent picture of what's going on. Some of our results, lab results, are in, but not everything. But the one underlying thing that we have seen is that generally across the board, these bats are in poor body condition or emaciated. They're just not doing well, which indicates that either either they went into hibernation, maybe in marginal condition, and they just didn't have enough fat stores to make it through, or they went into hibernation in good condition, but for some reason have really used up a lot more of their fat stores and haven't been able to make it through.
Okay.
The real puzzling thing here is that these hibernating bats go into winter hibernation in a typical year with adequate fat reserves to survive the winter.
Right.
And when they're down in that deep state of torpor, they're burning very little energy. And the fat that they accumulate going into a typical winter could last them far longer than a winter. But the problem is that they arouse from torpor. They bring their body temperature up to normothermic levels, so what are high body temperature like us. And those arousals, they have to do that for whatever reason, to drink, get rid of their bodily waste,
sure,
mate, to relocate within the hibernacula. And it's those natural arousals that consume the vast majority of energy during winters. And if anything is causing those arousals either to be more frequent or to last longer when the bat's up and burning energy, that's going to quickly tip the balance of this tight energy budget towards starvation. And so we could have many different things, whether it's a contaminant or pathogen, somehow increasing arousal frequency. There's a lot of things. It's a very complicated picture, and it's amazing that we have all these laboratories and ecologists and many diverse players involved and really working together.
And I think one of the last question that I have for you, for the two of you, is there like certain areas that are more perfect for this type of disease?
Well, that's something we would really like to know. It's hard to answer that because it's not clear if this is a disease problem that's primarily an infectious disease problem, meaning is it a disease that the bats are able to spread amongst themselves? So if it's something like that, because bats do move around quite a bit in the summer, it potentially could be something that could be transported to new areas. If it's that there are other factors going on that aren't infectious or contagious, then you'd need those conditions to exist at new areas for it to be a problem for bats. Does that make sense?
No, like climate-related conditions.
Right. If it's related to some other thing and not a contagious, infectious disease organism, then, you would need those things to be occurring at that site in order for it to be a possibility to occur in those bats. So that's one of the reasons that we really would like to try and pin down better just what some of the factors are, what's causing this, because then we can, as Paul said, take those next steps to determine whether there are things that we can do to minimize bat losses or stop this process.
Yeah, and that's the worst-case scenario is that this is something infectious, and I hope that it isn't. The bats from the affected areas and the affected caves that we've seen this winter do quite a bit of regional migration in all directions. And the areas that these bats migrate to during the summer overlap with areas that are visited by wintering bats from further south. So there's a real fear that if this is something infectious, it will move into those southern regions.
Well, let's hope that it isn't infectious and at least limited to a specific area. That way you can sort of close down where you're, you know, having to focus on, I guess, on the research and preventing this. Well, Paul and Kim, I appreciate you taking your time out of your morning to meet with me and discuss white nose syndrome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. My pleasure also.
Great. Well, that does it for this episode of the USGS Corecast. Thanks a lot for listening. And don't forget that you can get a transcript for this episode, related photos, and links by going to usgs.gov/corecast. And the USGS Corecast is a product of the U.S. Geological Survey, Department of the Interior. Until next time, I'm Scott Horvath, saying keep it cool.